Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Not once has an advisor of mine said, man, if we really use that phrase, we're going to turn this whole thing around. Not once.
The president lashes out against critics who demand he use the term radical Islam. But what's really in that phrase? We'll talk with a scholar of political Islam. Also, Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark on why she walked out of a moment of silence in Congress last night. And Harvard historian Jim Downs on the history of mass violence against the LGBT community.
They threw a firebomb on the steps that detonated and it blew up. Over 32 people died.
Plus, we'll look at whether the FDA should reassess its guidelines on blood donations from gay men.
When gay men can't give blood, we lose 2 to 4% of the potential blood supply. And that means we can't save as many lives.
It's Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, there are so many issues at play with the mass shooting in Orlando. It's an attack on the LGBT community. There are questions about gun control, about terrorism, and about the shooter's allegiance to ISIS. So it's inevitable that politics are stampeding in. We want to start today with a focus on a particular aspect of those politics, and that's the question of language. Here's Donald Trump on NBC's Today Show just yesterday talking about President Obama's use of language.
He's not addressing the issue. He's not calling it what it is. This is radical Islamic terrorism. This isn't fighting Germany. This isn't fighting Japan where they wear uniforms. And these are people that come out and you have no idea who they are. And he doesn't want to discuss it. He doesn't want to properly describe it.
Well, today, a response from the president. He spoke this afternoon following meetings with top anti-terrorism advisors, and after describing his administration's current efforts in the wake of the Orlando shooting, President Obama said this.
For a while now, the main contribution of some of my friends on the other side of the aisle have made in the fight against ISIL is to criticize this administration and me for not using the phrase radical Islam. That's the key, they tell us. We can't beat ISIL unless we call them radical Islamists. What exactly would using this label accomplish? What exactly would it change? Would it make ISIL less committed to trying to kill Americans? Would it bring in more allies? Is there a military strategy that is served by this? The answer is none of the above. Calling a threat by a different name does not make it go away. This is a political distraction.
That's President Obama earlier today. But really, there's a question here. Is it a political distraction? Words matter, and Obama himself knows that. He is a master at finding the language that captures the nation's mood. So what is the important difference then between radical Islamist and radical Islamic terrorism? What's the difference between those two phrases? For an answer, we're joined by Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman. He's a scholar of Islamic political thought and author of many books, including The Fall and Rise of the Islamic State. Noah Feldman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, just give us sort of a 101 on this. What is the difference between saying radical Islamist and radical Islamic when it comes to describing terrorism?
Well, probably the simplest way to do it is to start with the basics. So the faith or the religion is Islam, and a person who practices that religion is a Muslim. Everything else is a difference in English language adjectives that doesn't necessarily work or exist in other languages. So in Arabic, for example, there's no difference between Islamic and Islamist. So we should first be clear that we're talking about a usage in English.
Mm-hmm.
Next, as a matter of convention, Islamist in English is usually used to refer to people who treat Islam as the solution to political problems. So there's a famous slogan in the Muslim world, and it goes like this, quote, "Islam is the solution," close quote. And that's supposed to mean the solution to everything, including politics. And my short of hand is that if you believe that, if that slogan makes sense to you, then you count as an Islamist. Islamic is much, much broader. Islamic is an adjective that we use in English to describe anything that is in any way connected to Islam. And that explains a great deal, I think, about the disagreement between Donald Trump and President Obama.
Okay, so tell us more about that. So are you saying that you believe that one side, I mean, the president's approach is keeps it focused on the political implications of Islamist thinking in action, and his critics, including Donald Trump, are using a much broader brush?
I think that's a good way to think about it. I think when Donald Trump says radical Islam or says this is radical Islamic terrorism, he's suggesting that all Muslims are in some important way implicated by the nature of the actions of a few. And I think he intends to say that, and that's why his proposal was to keep all Muslims who were not American citizens out of the United States, not simply to choose people who have particular political views. He's, in other words, really focusing on the religion as the source of the problem. In contrast, President Obama is trying to really focus on the political aspects of a certain vision of Islam, and that's why I think even in his comments today, he used the phrase Islamist. And that also reflects President Obama's desire to build ties with potential U.S. allies, including Saudi Arabia and other countries, Pakistan, which are themselves Islamic. Pakistan is an Islamic republic, and Saudi Arabia is a country that treats Islam as its constitution. So in a fundamental sense, he's trying to create some space to say, I condemn terrorists and I condemn Islamic State, or ISIL as the president calls it, but I don't condemn Islam itself.
Yeah. Well, Noah Feldman, then, given what you just said, I'm not sure I agree with the president that this is a political distraction, because the language is important, and maybe it's not so much a distraction as it forced him to clarify exactly the term that he wants to use. I mean, do you think it's a political distraction?
I actually don't think it's a pure distraction. I mean, I think that Donald Trump's comments are a political distraction insofar as he was trying immediately after this terrible tragedy to focus attention on criticism of the president. And in that sense, I suppose it is a distraction. But I also agree with you that words matter. And when we evaluate the motivations of someone like Omar Mateen, we have to take into account that religious belief and faith have something to do, they can't fully explain, but they have something to do with his own self-described political values and ideals. We can't entirely pretend that for him, his religion was irrelevant to his actions, because he called 911 and announced that that was the case. So I think we have to take him at his word to some extent.
Hmm. Well, so there's the question of how particular language around this issue resonates to American ears. And then there's, and of course, and there's a multitude of types of ears just in our audience here at home. But then there's the question of how this language resonates to other audiences in other nations around the world, when high-profile speakers such as President Obama or Donald Trump or anyone seeking the White House uses particular language. And the president himself spoke to that point today. And he talked about how he wants to use specific terms because other terms are what ISIS or the so-called Islamic State wants America to use it. They could use it for their own propaganda. So here's what the president said.
They want us to validate them by implying that they speak for those billion-plus people, that they speak for Islam. That's their propaganda. That's how they recruit. And if we fall into the trap of painting all Muslims with a broad brush and imply that we are at war with an entire religion, then we are doing the terrorist work for them.
Noah Feldman, how does this current debate, distraction or not, how is this debate over language in America resonating to foreign audiences?
Well, I think the president is certainly right that if American politicians, including Donald Trump, declare that America is at war with Islam, then that unnecessarily and foolishly alienates the more than a billion Muslims, the vast majority of whom, of course, reject the use of violence and terrorism. That said, I think the president may have overstated the case by saying that simply referring to these terrorist acts as radical Islamic terrorism wins the propaganda battle for Islamic State. I'm not sure that that's completely true. Islamic State says that they represent the true Islam. They don't consider themselves radical, and they don't consider themselves terrorists. They consider themselves true Muslims. And I think it's pretty clear to most Muslims that this is ridiculous. But nevertheless, that's the claim that they're making. It would be a comparable mistake to say that these people speak for all of Islam, but it would be a mistake to say there's nothing at all Islamic about what they have to say.
Well, Noah, I'm curious. I mean, I appreciate that you've sort of walked us through the fine differences and the important distinctions between using the phrase Islamist versus Islamic. But when we're thinking about the broader public and especially how this language is used in an election season, you know, everything's whittled down to the smallest sound bites or tweets. Do you worry that these nuances get lost on the general public's ears?
There's no question that the nuances do get lost. But the big picture question I actually think is fairly clear to most Americans, and that is, do we say that the real problem here is Islam full stop, which is the line that Donald Trump seems to be pushing, or do we say, look, Islam has a problem within it, namely the problem of radical terrorism, and that needs to be fought and defeated, but it doesn't stand in for Islam itself. And I think actually that that's pretty clear and understandable even at the soundbite level.
No, if I may just push you gently here a little bit. I mean, you're a scholar of political Islam. How should we be talking about it? What should we be saying?
We should be seeing that Islam is a religion, and it's a religion that, like all religions, can be used in a wide variety of different ways. It can be used politically, it can be used as a matter of faith, and it can be interpreted just like the Bible can be interpreted. The Quran can be interpreted in a wide variety of ways. And what the United States is at war with is a particular brand of Islamic belief that interprets the tradition of Islam in an extreme and radical way that I think is, in a deep way, inconsistent with the great majority of Islamic tradition, and that's what we need to fight against.
So does that mean radical Islamist would be to get back to where we started, would be a preferred way of talking about this?
I myself don't think so. I think that Islamism is referring specifically to the political phenomenon, and that's not all that's going on here. There's politics and there's religion in play. But I think the key is to say radical and to say terror and to emphasize that that is the enemy and that Islam itself is not the enemy, even if some of the people against whom we're fighting and who are fighting against the United States are doing so because they believe themselves to be motivated by their religion.
Well, that's Noah Feldman. He's a professor of law at Harvard University and author of many books on political Islam, including The Fall and Rise of the Islamic State. Noah Feldman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
Well, let's turn now to another controversy that the president addressed today. That's gun control. Obama seemed to be speaking directly to Congress when he said that there are common sense steps, quote, consistent with the Second Amendment that could reduce gun violence. And this was in his afternoon press conference again. He then pointed to a specific proposal both introduced and denied in Congress last year.
People with possible ties to terrorism who aren't allowed on a plane shouldn't be allowed to buy a gun. Enough talking about being tough on terrorism. Actually, be tough on terrorism.
The president's comments come on the heels of a remarkable moment last night in the House. Several Democratic lawmakers walked out of the House chamber before representatives observed a moment of silence in honor of the Orlando victims. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton told WBUR why he walked out in protest.
Thoughts and prayers haven't worked. That's a tradition. We offer thoughts and prayers after one of these shootings. What we need to offer is real action to prevent them from happening again.
Well, things got even more heated after that moment of silence ended. House Speaker Paul Ryan tried to gavel the session back in.
To amend the High Performance Computing Act of 1991 to authorize activities for support of networking and information technology research.
Well, you can hear the shouting of, where's the bill, and show some respect. That's what Democrats were shouting. Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark was also among the lawmakers who walked out, and we spoke with her earlier today about why she did that and about the current climate in Congress.
My reaction to the shootings in Orlando are shared by Americans across the country. One of incredible sadness, but also outrage that Congress continues to have these moments of silence after a mass shooting, but we don't ever get to the point where we actually act. And at some point, I feel that these moments of silence are empty gestures that don't honor the victims.
Now, I wonder, there probably are some people listening who might say that walking out on a moment of silence held in honor of the victims, even given all that you just said, might be disrespectful to the victims. And what's your reaction to that?
I think when we don't act, that is what is disrespectful. That is what is not honoring the losses that we have had. We have to bring so many of these issues to votes. Let's talk about them. Let's have the debate and let's put ourselves on record.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about the climate and the tone in the House right now, because also yesterday evening, Democrat James Clyburn from South Carolina, of course, got up and wanted to speak and wanted to point out the fact that this coming Friday marks 1 year since the shooting, the horrible shooting at the historic Black church in Charleston, right? And so here we have a little bit of tape of this moment. Here he is yesterday trying to raise an inquiry after Speaker Paul Ryan ended the moment of silence the House was observing.
Is the gentleman stating a parliamentary inquiry?
Sorry, Speaker.
Is the gentleman stating a parliamentary inquiry?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
The gentleman shall state his inquiry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I am really concerned that we have just today had a moment of silence, and later this week, the 17th.
Is the gentleman stating a parliamentary inquiry?
Yes. Mr. Speaker, I am particularly interested about three pieces of legislation that have been filed in response
to Charleston. The gentleman's not stating a parliamentary inquiry.
So it goes on, that moment goes on, but essentially Speaker Ryan did interrupt Representative Clyburn. And I'm just wondering if you could help us get a better sense as to what this means about the fact that it was even difficult or impossible to talk about whether or not legislation was going to reach the floor.
I think it is showing one of the problems we have here is we're not even having the initial debate. It is long past time that we raise these issues, we have the debate, and we put ourselves on record. And when you see something that like what happened yesterday in the House, it makes you wonder, what is it that the Republican leadership is hiding from? And why won't they bring these forward?
Yeah. You know, so there are three specific bills, as you know, that Democratic leaders want votes on in the House. One of them is to close the so-called Charleston loophole, which would allow a person to buy a gun after 3 days, even if the background check isn't completed. That's what happened in the case of the Charleston shooting. And then there is there are two other bills that would seek to prevent people who are on the FBI's no-fly list from buying guns and prohibit anyone convicted of a hate crime from purchasing a firearm. So those are three specific pieces of legislation that Democrats are pushing for debate and a vote on. But I'm curious what you would say to residents, you know, in your own district or in Massachusetts who are concerned about these bills because they're worried that further restrictions on gun ownership in any way, even if it's for, you know, stopping potential terrorists, could inhibit their ability to legally own or limit their ability to legally own weapons.
All of our constitutional rights, everything enumerated in the Bill of Rights, has limitations that make all of us safer. There are limitations around the First Amendment and our right to speak. And there certainly need to be some common sense regulation and limits around the Second Amendment, because we are dealing with inherently dangerous weapons that are designed to kill.
Well, if I may ask Representative Clark, you know, I take the point of all you're just saying, but, you know, in a way, in a form of a political reality check, for as long as the Democrats are the minority party in the House, you know, it's the Republican Party that has the option of deciding what comes to the floor for debate and a vote and when. So, I mean, for as long as that is the makeup of the House, is there any other way for those people who wish to see these pieces of legislation, you know, see the light of day in Congress to make that happen? I'm not sure I can think of one.
Yeah, you know, if Congress isn't going to change in the light of these massacres, if shootings like Raekwon Brown's shooting if the mass shootings that took place, the shooting the night before in Orlando of a singer, and then the mass shooting that occurred at the Pulse nightclub, if those aren't going to get this Congress and Republican leadership to act, then it's time we change Congress. The members of Congress, if they're not doing their jobs to protect people from the worst gun violence in the world, then I don't think they deserve that job. And I think that we need to bring these things to a vote and make sure that they're held accountable at the polls if they won't be accountable to the American people in Congress.
Yeah. And you're reminding us of Raekwon Brown, the young man, the student from the Jeremiah Burke High School, who was killed just outside the high school in Dorchester. Finally, Representative Clark, I would love to tap your expertise on something. Because President Obama spoke today about a briefing that he had received from his national security advisors, including the director of the FBI, about strategies to defeat ISIS. And he mentioned several things, but one thing in particular made me think of you, because he was talking about how it seems increasingly evident that the Orlando shooter took in information, extremist information over the internet. And then he said lone actors are hard to identify and their actions are difficult to prevent. And that got me thinking of the fact that you have been very active in trying to combat sort of a different type of lone actor, those people who engage in so-called swatting, right, when they anonymously call police departments and law enforcement officials and send highly armed SWAT teams to innocent people's houses. I was just wondering if there's anything that you have learned in your attempts to advocate for how to stop that kind of lone wolf that you think might apply in the nation's effort, to stop lone wolves who may be inspired by ISIS and other groups?
That is an excellent question. And I think what I have learned is that we need to find those areas across the aisle where we can work together. And with the swatting bill in particular, I have been able to work with Republicans. But we need a concerted effort, and we have to make sure that not only, the FBI have the resources they need, but also that our local police have a good understanding of how these crimes are committed, how where they can go for help, where they can have resources and training in dealing with a whole new level of threat, and that's the recruitment and the radicalization of Americans. And I think there are ways for people across the political spectrum to come together for the security of the American people and work on these issues.
Catherine Clark is the representative for Massachusetts 5th District. She's speaking to us today from Washington. Representative Clark, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna. It's good to be with you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You've heard this a lot, and quite frankly, my heart sinks every time I have to say it, but I do need to say it, that Sunday's massacre in Orlando is the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. And it's also the deadliest instance of violence against the LGBT community in modern American history. Well, Jim Downs has chronicled that long history of attacks against the gay community. He's an associate professor of history at Connecticut College and a fellow at Harvard University. And his latest book is Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. And he joins us now from NPR in New York. Jim Downs, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to have you back because we thought that it was worth going over this history once again in the light of what happened in Orlando. And I do want you to walk us through some of the other awful attacks on the gay community. But can I just first get your response to how you felt and what your reaction was after we all found out what happened on Sunday morning in Orlando?
I sort of personally, I felt empty, but I think as a historian, I wasn't surprised. I think by spending over a decade working on the massive massacre of gay people in New Orleans in 1973 and tracking other forms of violence. I think about this all the time. Every time I walk into a gay bar, every time I see news about suspicious activity among and within the gay community, it seems to me that this story is deeply tragic, and it's much larger in scale, but it's not so much of an aberration in terms of the kinds of violence, discrimination, harassment that gay people deal with on a daily basis.
So the fact that you think about these things every time you walk into a bar or other kind of facility like that, I want to ask you a little bit more about that in a minute. But tell us about what happened at the previous largest attack on the gay community, right, as you mentioned, in New Orleans in 1973.
So in 1973, a group of gay people gathered in New Orleans in June to celebrate Pride Month, which is happening this month currently. And they had heard of news of the Stonewall Uprising, which was the official start of gay liberation. And so they piled into this bar in New Orleans at the Upstairs Lounge to celebrate the fourth anniversary. And there was a beer blast and there was parties and Cher was playing on the disco machine. And around 7 o'clock, the beer bust ended, and there was a meeting of the congregation of the Metropolitan Community Church. This was a fledgling community of people who couldn't find spaces in other churches or other places. So the Upstairs Lounge was willing to allow them to meet on Sunday nights. And so around 7 p.m., about 60 or more people gathered on the second floor of the bar in the Upstairs Lounge. And the way that it was set up was that the first floor was a straight bar and the third floor was a flop house. Mm-hmm. And so essentially, the people are there and they're singing and they're praying and they're congregating, rocking back and forth. And someone rings the doorbell. And in New Orleans in 1973 at a gay bar, they had to always be safe. So the doors were locked. And there was actually a hatch that sort of resembled a Prohibition speakeasy where you could kind of like look out to see if anyone was coming. And so the bartender assumed that when he heard the doorbell ring that someone called for a taxi, and he called out to the crowd and everyone said no one called. And so he went back up to cleaning up the bar. And a few minutes later, the doorbell rang again. And at this point, he motioned to one of the patrons to open the door. And when they did, a fire exploded. Someone, or maybe a group of people, we still don't know, 40 years later, threw a firebomb on the steps of the second floor leading into the Upstairs Lounge. And within minutes, the building incinerated. And
as you said, the doors were locked.
Right. The doors were locked and the windows were barricaded. This is New Orleans in 1973. So, and then the power went out. It was dark. People couldn't figure their, couldn't get out. They didn't know how to escape. Some of the men tried to, you know, push their bodies through these sort of narrow bars. And the Reverend William Larson, who led the congregation in prayer and song, noticed there was a window and an air conditioner in the window. And he pushed the air conditioner through the window in order to wedge his body out. But as he did it, the building was sort of crumbling, and an air conditioner from the floor above him fell on his head, and he got stuck in the building. And so the horrific death of these people, there were over 32 people died, and it so eerily evoked and resembled what we heard in Orlando. Bodies of gay men in the Upstairs Lounge in New Orleans were found in the bathroom, underneath the piano, melted together. I mean, literally, the descriptions that we see in Orlando of how people were trying to take cover and refuge in closets, behind bar, at any place. It was the same thing that happened in New Orleans.
Well, let me ask you, you said that we still don't know who the perpetrators were of this crime.
Right. So it was unclear. I mean, at first, there's a lot of work done on the police and fire department records, and I've read through all of them. And the police did a thorough investigation. They interviewed everyone. They took copious notes, but they were never able to identify who the person was. And in fact, just like the story that's happening today, people began to say, oh, it's a member of the gay community. And that's what struck me last night when I first heard this and the possibility that the culprit in this particular crime was homosexual. I thought this is following a very similar historical pattern to what happened in New Orleans. There's this understanding, there's this idea of marking someone as gay, and then that connotes this kind of old late 19th century notion of homosexuality as a psychological disorder. And then that becomes the sort of narrative that helps to sort of rationalize and explain why someone would do this. So I thought, again, we have to be careful about assigning sexual identity to him because that plays into many different registers.
Right.
And it immediately sort of sets off all of these other sort of stereotypes about gay people that are highly problematic.
Yeah, so just so in case some people don't know, you're talking about how in the past 24 hours there's been a lot of reporting that the Orlando shooter had gone to the Pulse nightclub frequently and had been using gay dating apps as well. So There's a lot of speculation there.
Even if you do a closer reading of it, just the idea that there was one eyewitness account that said he brushed by me on the street and he was kind of shady, I didn't trust him. This same thing happens in the archival evidence from the New Orleans fire. There's evidence of, I saw him walking out of the bathroom. He brushed by me. He wouldn't make eye contact. I mean, it's honestly identical. And again, it plays into all of these notions about queer people not being able to be trusted. Queer people are suspicious. And sometimes LGBT people, without even knowing it, sort of are articulating these narratives about other gay people. Because I could see someone like that and say they're uncomfortable in a bar. They don't know anyone. They're not necessarily being shady. They're just uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how these patterns are playing out in both cases.
So, Jim, let me ask you briefly. There's also this other issue about how, you were saying earlier that these spaces had been, bars and meeting areas had been safe spaces for members of the LGBT community. And both now as then, many of these people may not have even been out to their own friends and family, but in their death, their death outed them.
Right.
How was that handled in 1973?
Well, in 1973, it was deeply problematic because the first piece was that many of the funeral parlors wouldn't even bury the bodies or get near the bodies. And this is a story that we know that happens after HIV and the outbreak of AIDS. A similar sort of pattern develops. But at that particular moment, many of the gay men in the 1970s may have been celebrating Stonewall. They may have been celebrating gay pride, as many people are doing this June. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're out to their coworkers. That doesn't mean that they're out to their families. And as a result, many of the bodies were left unidentifiable. And also because some gay people go to big cities like Orlando or New Orleans or New York to start over. This is the American dream. You get to reinvent yourself. And part of that is sometimes coming up with another sort of identity and another name. And that just makes it that much more complicated in the 1970s because so many of the bodies were unidentifiable. And today, that's what I was thinking about in the immediate wake of this. I mean, there's so much talk about Trump and there's so much talk about what his reaction to it is. I want to stop that for a second and place a moratorium on Trump and just say there are families that will learn about their siblings, their cousins, their possibly their husbands as gay when they go to the morgue to identify their body. Mm-hmm. And that's a long history of homophobia that has created that moment, that has nothing to do with the presidential election, has nothing to do with how people are framing this, and that has something to do with how we as a culture and we as a community continue to vilify gay people to the point that despite all of these major political moments of acceptance and legal recognition by the courts, they still can't come out to their families.
Well, on that note, in the last minute or so that we have, let me ask you this question, because I heard you at the beginning of our conversation talk about this sense of fear. And yesterday on our show, we had a guest saying that, he had started feeling more relaxed and at ease in the world after the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage across the nation just last year. And he felt that sense of security had been ripped away by what happened in Orlando. Can you talk to us for a minute about sort of what Orlando and these other events mean for the collective memory of the LGBT community?
I think they mean a lot. I think that in 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, this might make it as a footnote in history, maybe even a headline. But at that, but at the same time, many gay people will remember this and they will live with it. And this is not me as a historian practicing psychology, but when I did my book on the 1970s, I was struck by the fact that gay men in New York City at the height of gay liberation were reading about, thinking about, talking about the Nazi persecution of homosexuals decades before and across the ocean. And they had read about the persecution of homosexuals. No, it wasn't in history books. It was gay activists going out and finding the archival information and literally carrying it back to New York, telling activists there. And they started to think, maybe our movement, maybe our community will be eradicated just like the communities that thrived in Berlin in the 1930s, but then were subsequently destroyed by Hitler. So in other words, here you have a population of people who are still affected by the memory of violence and persecution of another group of gay people in another place. And I think about how that will impinge on the memory that many gay people will have today of their culture and of their people.
Well, Jim Downs is an associate professor of history at Connecticut College. He's also a fellow at Harvard University. And his latest book is Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. Jim Downs, thank you so much for joining us once again today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got more information about Jim and his book at our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're starting to hear more from survivors of the Orlando shooting. Several of them held a press conference today at the hospital that's treating most of the survivors. Angel Cologne, a Framingham native, spoke about what it was like inside the club.
Everyone started running everywhere. I got trampled over. All I could do was just lay down there while everyone was just running on top of me, trying to get to where they had to be. And I can hear the shotguns closer, and I look over, and he shoots the girl next to me. And I'm just there laying down. I'm thinking, I'm next. I'm dead.
Angel was shot in the hand and hip, and he spoke today sitting in a wheelchair. Hospital officials said six of the people injured in the shooting are still critically injured, while another five are in guarded condition. Now, in response to the Orlando shooting, maybe you remember seeing some of these images of thousands of people lining up to give blood over the weekend. And on Sunday, Orlando City Commissioner Patty Sheehan told MSNBC this.
I understand that the blood banks are accepting blood from everyone, because I think that's appropriate right now, because there has been a ban on gay men donating blood. And I think it's appropriate right now. You can screen the blood, and maybe this tragedy is the one thing that took that ban away.
Well, Patty Sheehan was incorrect, and the One Blood Donation Center quickly corrected her, tweeting that all FDA guidelines remain in place, meaning that no gay man who hasn't been celibate for at least 1 year can give blood. And of course, that led to a great deal of frustration felt by many, many members of the LGBT community. And it also prompted questions on whether or not the FDA should lift the ban and what that might mean. So here to help us understand this issue is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Meghna.
So over the past couple of days, we've seen this outpouring of support, obviously for the victims in Orlando. But you say there's a controversial issue here as well.
Well, yes, there is. I mean, you can understand that, of course, everyone is just overwhelmed with this desire to help after such a horrible event. But so you can also imagine the frustration that met some people if, say, you want to give blood to help the victims, but you're told that you can't because you're a gay man, and you're not celibate. Jared Polis, who's a gay congressman from Colorado, even tweeted, "We must overturn the morally bankrupt / dangerous ban on gay people giving blood. It's absurd that someone can't even donate blood to their own husband."
Yeah. And I was seeing tweets of people saying that it's easier for a gay man to buy an assault weapon than it is to donate blood to people in need. So obviously a lot of attention on this issue right now. But from your reporting, I mean, it was already brewing.
It was already brewing. So here's the the backstory. These regulations were put into place way back a generation ago, back at the start of the AIDS epidemic. It was basically a lifetime ban on giving blood if you were a gay man, which back then was understandable, right? You might be carrying HIV. And remember, actually, you're probably too young, but we were told that it can take months for the HIV to be detectable.
So I'm flattered, but I'm not too young.
Yeah, okay. So the FDA put in a lifetime ban on gay men donating blood. Now, more recently, just last December, the FDA revised its rule and it said you can give blood if you're a gay man, but only if you've been celibate for the last 12 months, if you've had no sex with any other men over the last 12 months. Now, that's widely seen as progress. At least it's better than a lifetime ban, but it's not enough for some activists. I spoke with Jay Franzone. He's a senior at LaSalle College here in Newton, and he's the spokesman for a group called the National Gay Blood Drive, and they've been pushing since 2013 for the ban on gay men giving blood to be lifted.
When gay men can't give blood, we lose 2-4% of the potential blood supply. And that means we can't save as many lives. And in situations like the Orlando massacre, we lose the ability to respond rapidly to crises. And so we have lines of people out the blood donation center door, and half of those people are being turned away because they can't actually give blood.
But Carrie, help me clarify. I mean, what does Jay think about the new FDA guidelines? I mean, why does he think that that's not enough?
Well, he says they are progress. But first of all, it takes time for them to be put into practice. And in a lot of blood donation centers, they're not in practice yet. The centers have to train up their staffs, change their computer systems. But the argument is also that it's discriminatory, that basically you're in a category of gay men, you're banned in a blanket way, when in fact, the level of risk that you pose as possibly carrying HIV should be based on your individual behavior and not on whether you belong to this group. So you could be a gay man who's been in a monogamous relationship with an HIV negative person for a very long time. You could be a heterosexual person who's been having a lot of high risk sex or injecting drugs. And so it's just they see it as discriminatory.
I see. But I gather that it's not only gay men who are under this blanket ban, this requirement of being celibate for 12 months. People who've had transfusions or otherwise been exposed to other people's blood also have to wait 12 months before they can donate.
That's right. And you can totally understand that as a societal goal, we want to have a safe blood supply. But the point is that gay men are the only group who have been banned as a group. So when you go in to give blood, you're usually asked to fill out a questionnaire, like where you've traveled and what medications you're taking and so on. And again, they're arguing that the level of your risk should be determined by your own individual behaviors and not by what group you belong to.
Right. And Carrie, the original ban went in, just to remind folks, because I think it's important to underscore this, back in the 80s, in the height of the AIDS epidemic, when the gay community was really struck hard by this. And technology was different then. I mean, we're decades later. So, you know, tell me about the state of the art when it comes to testing the actual blood when people go in to donate.
Right. So we have come a long way on testing the actual blood. The science has come a long way. I spoke with Sean Cahill. He's the director of health policy research at the Fenway Institute. And he says there have been a couple of main technological improvements in testing blood for communicable diseases.
There's a nucleic acid test that is used to screen blood after it's been donated. And that can typically detect the presence of HIV now in just about 9 to 11 days after infection.
So you can see the gap there, 9 to 11 days, but the rule says you have to not have had sex for a year. That's a big difference. And then also Cahill says there are new technologies called pathogen inactivation technologies. So basically, you know, even if there are problematic viruses or bacteria in there, they can treat the blood and try to kill them. So basically, the blood supply in general is a lot safer from HIV than it used to be.
Right. And the 9 to 11 days after infection of being able to detect HIV, that's a huge change. I mean, it used to take months, right? Decades
right.
ago.
Yes,
okay.
That is a huge change.
So really some profound advancements in the technology or detection technology for blood samples. But what about the overall argument that men who have sex with men have a heightened risk of being potential HIV carriers.
Right. And that's the complex issue, right? And Sean Cahill says, yes, that's true. 15% of gay men are HIV positive, but 85% are HIV negative. So that's why it makes more sense to judge someone based on their individual risk factors.
I see. So ultimately, Carrie, it seems that one of the repercussions of the awful atrocity that happened in Orlando might be that it's casting more light on this issue of whether or not this ban on gay men donating blood should be lifted.
Right. And it's giving more impetus to a push that was already underway to try to get the ban lifted. In fact, just last night in Congress, there's word on the Huffington Post that some Congress people started circulating a letter to the FDA saying, you should lift this ban. Here's what Sean Cahill of the Fenway Institute says.
Maybe one positive thing that could come out of this horrible terrorist attack is that people will look at this policy and understand that in a crisis situation like we had in Orlando, you know, we need blood. And I mean, there were plenty of people who were HIV negative who could have donated and they just weren't allowed to donate.
Now, Meghna, I should note there has been enough blood in Orlando. That's what the authorities are saying. The American Red Cross is saying that. The FDA issued a statement saying that, yeah, there is enough blood and, quote, the scientific evidence is not available to support an alternative to the current deferral policy. They say they empathize with the people who might wish to donate and they're committed to reevaluating their policies as new scientific information becomes available.
Interesting. So they have a slightly different view from the other people you talked to about the science, and they're not even addressing the discriminatory charges that that people you talk to are saying that the FDA policy has.
Right. My read is they're saying nothing's going to happen right away. Longer term, we'll see.
Well, we will see. Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Carrie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, switching gears for a moment, we've got an important update on the makeup of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Governor Charlie Baker has just named three new justices to the bench, Superior Court Judges David Lowy, Kimberly Budd, and Frank Gaziano. The two men were first appointed judges by Republican governors, including Governor William Weld and Governor Mitt Romney. And Kimberly Budd is an African-American woman who had been appointed to the Superior Court by Democratic Governor Deval Patrick. David Lowy has been a judge for 19 years and worked with Baker in the Weld administration. His resume also includes 12 years as a vendor at Fenway Park. Kimberly Budd has been a judge for 7 years and previously worked as an attorney at Harvard University and as a federal prosecutor. And Frank Gaziano is a former state and federal prosecutor. The Governor's Council will schedule confirmation hearings for the three nominees in the coming weeks. We'll bring you more on that as we have it. Well, finally today, as members of the media, permit us a moment for some navel-gazing, prompted by this.
You know my opinion of the media. It's very low. I think the media is, frankly, made up of people that, in many cases, not in all cases, are not good people.
Well, that, of course, is Donald Trump, presumptive GOP nominee for president. He was speaking about this a little earlier this year. Well, in a Facebook post just yesterday, Trump sharpened his distaste for the media, specifically The Washington Post, writing, quote, based on the incredibly inaccurate coverage and reporting of the record-setting Trump campaign, we are hereby revoking the press credentials of the phony and dishonest Washington Post, end quote. So the Post is banned from the Trump campaign, and it's in good company. The Trump campaign has also given the boot to BuzzFeed, Politico, and the New Hampshire Union Leader, Univision, and the Huffington Post, amongst others. Well, the Post's executive editor, Marty Baron, said in a statement yesterday, quote, Donald Trump's decision to revoke the Washington Post press credentials is nothing less than a repudiation of the role of a free and independent press. Well, Boston readers are familiar with Marty Baron's unflinching style because he's also the former editor of the Boston Globe. He led the Globe during its Pulitzer Prize-winning expose of the Catholic clergy sex abuse crisis. So we invited Baron to talk with us today. He couldn't join us, but he was in Boston earlier this month at a WBUR event, and he gave a speech about the importance of journalism in modern America, and he touched on the very same themes we see playing out today. So we wanted to play you a moment of that speech about Marty Baron speaking about the role of journalists in a democracy.
There is no assumption that we will always get to the truth, because we know that the truth can be elusive. But there is an assumption that we must be strivers, that we will strive to get things as right as humanly possible. and that when we do all that, we will tell the public what we found. Honestly, honorably, accurately, and fairly, but also unflinchingly. Today, we live in a world where falsehoods proliferate. They corrode the political process. They allow conspiracy theories to take root. And they give rise to politicians who advance agendas by embracing what they know to be lies. In this world, someone must pursue and tell the truth. And that is our obligation as journalists. Our profession depends on it. Our democracy depends on it too. If we expect to enjoy the gift of free expression, we must accept that as our duty. Always.
That's Marty Baron, executive editor of The Washington Post, speaking at a WBUR event earlier this month. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.